Today, we're going to talk about the brain-body connection with behavior and learning. We'll talk about how to spot the signs that your child is struggling and a new roadmap for improving behavior and building more resilient kids. This is LD Expert Live. Welcome to LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning differences, dyslexia, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers and author of At Wit's End, A Parent's Guide to Ending the Struggle, Tears, and Turmoil of Learning Disabilities. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens struggle in school and what can be done to change that permanently. To get a free copy, go to parents@witsend.com. Our guest today is Dr. Mona Delahook. Mona is a licensed clinical psychologist with more than 30 years of experience caring for children and their families. She is a senior faculty member of the Profectum Foundation, an organization dedicated to supporting families of neurodiverse children, adolescents, and adults, and the author of Beyond Behaviors and her upcoming book, Brain Body Parenting. Welcome, Mona.
Thank you so much, Jill. I am so excited to be with you today.
I'm so happy to have you here with us today, too. I feel like I'm talking to a kindred spirit. Your approach to behavioral challenges is so similar to our approach with learning challenges.
That's fantastic. We're going to have a great conversation then.
You know, I always love to hear people's stories. So what is the story behind your work with children with challenging behaviors and developmental differences?
Well, stories usually have a link to the heart. So one of my stories, I have a lot of them, but one of my stories is that I had a baby that was premature, and her way of being in the world was not something that I was taught about in psychology graduate school. So I was a psychologist for quite a few years before I became a mother. And then I tried to apply these tools and techniques that I learned from the field, and they just fell short. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with me? as many moms and dads do, it's like, what am I doing wrong? Well, as it turns out, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I just didn't understand the nervous system of my little baby and of my child. So long story short, that ended up about a decade into my career as a psychologist, I went back to school and I did postgraduate training in infant and toddler development, where I learned about the brain, I learned about the body, the nervous system, and individual differences. And that made all the difference in the world. When I added that to my psychology training, it was a winning combination. And that's kind of all the work that I do now, is an integrated approach that combines the body and the brain, mm-hmm. as well as social and emotional development, which many therapists and teachers don't really know much about either.
You know, in our learning centers, it's called a learning center. So of course, you know, our focus is learning, but really everything that you talked about encompasses learning. You have to look at all of those pieces. When students have learning challenges, they often resist doing homework, and parents find themselves working very hard to get past that resistance. And, you know, the real problem isn't the whining or the avoidance. It's the fact that the child is mentally exhausted or doesn't have the skills to do the job. Well, when kids have challenging behaviors, the same is true. I mean, the parent spends a lot of time managing behavior, but the behavior is just a symptom. So responding to behavior differently requires looking at behavior differently. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about that paradigm shift in how behavior is viewed.
Absolutely. Well, truly, I think our culture, certainly our educational culture, and even our mental health world, our systems, are quite obsessed with behaviors as the target. Mm-hmm. As you know, there are big industries that look at behaviors and how to decrease problematic behaviors or challenging behaviors or non-compliance. So that system, which views behaviors as the target, mm-hmm. When you look at relational neuroscience and you really look at the work post the decade of the brain, which is in the 1990s, what I discovered is that the way we are treating behaviors as the target instead of the signal of what's happening in that brain-body connection is the needed paradigm shift. Because when we over-focus on behaviors, and again, I have an ask for everyone who's listening right now, and that this is a no blame, no shame situation. If you're a teacher or a parent and you're like, I'm looking at my child's behaviors, or I'm focusing on that, please have compassion for yourself. This is how we're trained. This is how we're taught, is that we need to help our children have better behaviors. But truly, the paradigm shift is that behaviors are the tip of the iceberg. And what lies underneath, the invisible part under the waterline, are those millions of causes that we need to look at before we start messing around with behaviors, because behaviors can be protective. And they often are protective to our children.
Absolutely. You know, I think about that with coping strategies. When kids have learning challenges, they do things that once their learning challenges are changed, they don't need those behaviors anymore. But while they're in the midst of the struggle, those are protective. That's absolutely right. It's how they manage.
They're protective. And I think a very important concept for us to understand is that they are not volitionally or intentionally mediated. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. It means that not all behaviors are created by the child with intentionality. In other words, children don't generally think about throwing something off their table or ripping their paper in half ahead of time. It's often a stress behavior, a stress response that is subconsciously mediated by the body's system of protection. And that system of protection moves us into activities that might look agitated and usually involve movement. That is the nervous system's way of trying to feel calm again. Mm-hmm. So it's really a whole mind-bending shift from how we usually view behaviors, which is something we want to discourage. Like if a child is having, a tantrum, that we try to help them end the tantrum as quickly as possible, rather than being curious about what is that stress pathway that is happening for this child or teenager or even ourselves that needs to be attended to?
You have a new book coming out, Brain Body Parenting, where I think you have some practical tools for parents in understanding this and just working with their children in a different way. In fact, I think it was announced yesterday, right?
It was. It's so nice of you to bring it up today. We did the official launch of Brain Body Parenting yesterday. And it's a book of my heart, truly. As I told people yesterday, I had written a book called Beyond Behaviors several years ago. And that book chronicled a lot of the stories that I've of some of the families over the last, over my practice really of almost 30 years, of the ways we navigated through the school system and with a child's team, including whoever they had on their team, their speech therapist, their occupational therapist, their teachers, their family members. So Beyond Behaviors kind of set out a new, the paradigm shift in helping children with behavioral challenges. But in my heart, I knew that the principles of resiliency and neurodevelopment, that is how brains develop within relationships, was a parenting book that needed to be written, because it's not quite spelled out there in a way that I see and talk about in my practice. So anyway, you know, the COVID, different COVID lockdowns provided me an opportunity to not travel as much as I had before, and time to write this book. And so it's called Brain Body Parenting, because it's bringing into our awareness the nervous system of the child and how to customize our interactions based on each child's nervous system, their brain-body connection. And it moves beyond generic tools to really customizing our tools for each child. So thank you for mentioning it.
Oh, it sounds like it's going to be a wonderful resource. And it's on pre-order now.
Yeah, right? It's available Amazon? For pre-order. Mm-hmm. And you can, there's a link on my website where actually for pre-orders only, because pre-orders are, you know, they send a message to the publishing world. So they're kind of cool, but we've done these goodies that you get, including a membership to a free brain body parenting masterclass that I'll be doing.
Oh, nice.
So yeah. So on the pre-order, that's a 3-week course that I'm going to be spelling out everything right after publication date, March 15th. And I just can't wait to have as many parents and professionals as possible on that, in that kind of parenting boot camp that I'll be describing these concepts, which are still pretty, you know, they're new. They're new. And so, yeah, go to my website, or it's also available, of course, on Amazon. But the pre-order goodies are available when you go to my website at monadellahook.com.
Perfect. And we'll put that up again towards the end of the show. So that is wonderful. I'm going to take advantage of that myself.
Oh, yay. It'll be so fun. It'll be so fun to have you.
Well, I know a lot of, you've talked a lot about the work of Dr. Stephen Porges with his polyvagal theory, and you have a really great way of explaining it with color. Can you just give us kind of that picture of how to think about the nervous system and what's going on with color?
With color, absolutely. Well, I am a psychologist and not a researcher, so one of my favorite things to do is to translate science into easy to understand stuff like colors, because that's how my brain works. And the polyvagal theory, which I was luckily exposed to over 20 years ago, is a very dense theory about the evolution of the autonomic nervous system. And the, It took me a while to get to the heart of the matter and apply it to what it means for our children. But the implications to education and mental health, in my opinion, are huge. And they made such a big difference in how I work with families and help parents understand their children. So in a nutshell, the polyvagal theory describes three pathways of something called the autonomic nervous system. And these three pathways are developed phylogenetically according to evolution in how human beings' systems subconsciously help them stay safe. And so the three pathways I decided to name as colors, and there are different functions of the pathways. So the pathway that I call the green pathway is also known as the ventral vagal pathway, but that is the pathway of social engagement. And that is the pathway that is used when a child or an adult feels safe, they feel calm, their body is calm, and their physiology is calm. And it's calm because their subconscious and conscious bodies are interpreting safety in their world. And so they're feeling good. Of course, this is where parents love to see their children and teachers, right? Your child is open to learning. They can stretch a bit. They have frustration tolerance or more frustration tolerance. So that's the green pathway. But as we all know, nobody lives in the green pathway. We don't all stay calm all the time. We can't, first of all, because then we'd be robots and not humans. But when we detect some sort of threat, and that threat could be coming from a thought, an emotion. It could be coming from physical pain inside of our bodies, or lack of sleep, or lack of nutrition, or lack of something to drink. So it can come from a lot of different places. But when the nervous system detects threat, the other pathway that it defaults into is something called the sympathetic nervous system, which I call the red pathway. In the red pathway, a human is poised to move. And that could be moving your mouth, yelling, screaming. It could be moving your body, pushing, shoving, whining, tearing papers, throwing things, spinning. Those in the sympathetic nervous system, and we've all been there, right? We've all lost it. If you're a parent and you have never lost it, then I'm a little bit concerned about you, because we all have a sympathetic nervous system that's there to protect us through movement. So when you see your child having these agitated, out of control behaviors, or you experience it yourself, understand that that's the body registering a certain amount of stress and trying to get back to calm. Finally, there's the blue pathway, and the third major pathway. And the blue pathway is where we would see disconnection. A person may stop moving, including doesn't want to play, they don't want to connect, they don't want to talk to us, and they can kind of give up. And that's a concerning pathway. We don't want children to stay there for days or weeks on end. That is a pathway of extreme stress in the body. And then researchers in the last decade or two have also found that there are mixed or blended pathways. And that's a very new and exciting area of research. So just understand that these colors can overlap in certain ways. And I talk about that a little bit in the new book.
Well, that is a really helpful way to look at it. And I love what you said there. Just, it's worth repeating that when the system is stressed, movement is a way to try to start to bring us back. And so some of the things that we see, I mean, when you said spitting, we don't really think of that in that term. We think of that as, you know, a very bad choice of behavior.
Yes, a purposeful misbehavior. Yes. In the sympathetic nervous system, spitting is instinctual. Biting would be in the same category. And so we really, and I'm so glad you brought up that idea about a bad choice, because we have to understand that those kinds of body up behaviors aren't choices. Mm-hmm. And we get in trouble. And what I mean by that is that we can dig the hole even deeper for the child's nervous system if we accuse them of having a bad choice when their body is in control. Because what happens if you tell a child that they made a bad choice and they don't know that their nervous system was in control? They feel humiliated. They can feel shameful. And human beings start to make up stories so that they don't feel shame. Like, he hit me first, or someone took something from me, because human beings don't like to feel shame. So it's really important to understand that not every challenging behavior is a bad choice. Some of it is a default of our nervous system trying to protect us.
Wow. That really is a paradigm shift, and really, really important in then addressing the real issue.
Yeah.
You know, at the Learning Center, we look at behavior as a teaching opportunity. We call it that. And so we have to think, what is the child's response or behavior telling us? I'm sure you have many, many stories, but I'm wondering if you could tell us a story or two that would illustrate the brain-body connection.
Sure. So we can think of one story that is actually many stories as a theme that has come up, a theme that comes up with the families that I have seen in my practice is children who have been either asked to leave their school or mm-hmm. who are on, you know, whose parents are getting called and the child is being sent to the office. So let's think about little Benny, who's he's a young kindergartner and who has a habit of standing up and kind of touching the heads of those little kids sitting around him, of his classmates. So he just had this need to kind of touch their heads and make contact with them. And it was a behavior that was distracting for the teacher and confusing for the other children. And it seemed to not be amenable to asking him to please sit down or help giving him a sticker chart and encouragement. Like, if you don't get up and bop kids on the head, then you'll earn all these goodies, you know, at the end mm-hmm. of the day or at the end of the week. And so when we looked below the tip of the iceberg, little Benny wanted, as all kids do, I really believe all kids want to please. And they, as Ross Green says, children do well if they can. And I really believe that children want to do well. Little Benny had no idea that his system, specifically in this child's individual difference, his proprioceptive and vestibular systems, these are systems of sensory processing and how we understand the world and how we stay calm, needed movement. And so his system needed to feel things, needed to feel the pressure off of his hands to stabilize that green pathway, to help him feel calm enough in his body to go back to his seat and sit down. Now, unfortunately, it involved his peers, but once we figured it out, we came up with these beautiful accommodations that really honored that need for him to feel his body in space. And so for this particular little guy, we had things, fidget toys in his desk. We had the ability for him to walk when he needed it, to push his hands against a wall and to feel that wall and push his arms out. And we came up with really fun stuff for him to do that wasn't a shaming or embarrassing, but letting him know, hey, sweetheart, pay attention to what your body needs and let your teacher know, or just quietly do this. And then after that, little Benny's behaviors of touching his peers stopped because we've got below the tip of the iceberg.
Right. And oh my gosh, I love that story. I mean, it's a great illustration because we would tend to want to handle that differently, to tell him that's not okay and set up, you know, rules or set up rewards. And he isn't going to be able to do that because it isn't an intentional behavior. It's serving a need that he has. So
precisely. So, and he didn't know that. Kids don't know their subconsciously driven instincts. So that's a beautiful way of saying it. That's why all the incentives and the, again, well-meaning, wonderful teacher who was so kind to him and like a cheerleader. But you can cheerlead all you want. If the child's body is driving the behavior And this is what I'm really hammering home in brain body parenting, which is why we call it brain body, is that we've left out the body in our education system. The body is really pretty hard to find, and the nervous system isn't really talked about either. So when we just talk about a child trying harder, we're thinking that all behaviors are top down instead of understanding the nature of bottom or body up behaviors.
Right. And the thing is, when you tell that child, it's funny because I was just working with a boy, very similar name, actually, the other day, who is that child? His body is in constant motion. He's always driving parents, teachers, everybody crazy because he seems, he just can never sit still. He, you know, hits people, knocks people down, you know, is very, very busy, and it has really been viewed and dealt with as behavior. But what we see truly is that his body is completely out of his control. And as soon as we started talking to him about that, just to start to build an awareness and an acceptance that, okay, here's what's going on. Now let's come up with some things that are going to work for you. It's like he was like suddenly acted more mature. I mean, just in that little interaction that we had the other day, he responded so maturely, like, yeah, that is what's happening.
Beautiful. That is such a beautiful story, Jill. And it illustrates this concept of witnessing someone in a new way, because he probably felt when you and the others were maybe talking to him with compassion and giving him the benefit of the doubt, he probably felt it. He felt your emotional tone, and he felt this idea that, oh, I'm not getting in trouble right now. I'm being asked to be a partner in this. And that's just, I'm just so thrilled that you all have this beautiful way of helping children not feel that they are bad, or that they are purposefully trying to make life difficult for the people around them, because it's really a misunderstanding of behavioral challenges. And believe me, it's fueled by partly by my field of psychology and the DSM language of some of these diagnoses that I think are going to be also outdated in a decade or so. But for now, we're stuck with them.
Yeah. And, you know, with both behavioral issues and learning, often the child or the adult, I mean, it's not just kids, but the child is often trying really hard, and that's extremely discouraging, and it's hard to trust themselves or anything they know, because it doesn't look like they're trying. They are trying, but it just, that what we see on the outside doesn't look like they're trying, and so it makes the world a pretty insecure place.
Absolutely. And that's the lens shift, that when we see a child who is moving their body in a way that appears to be non-compliant or goofy or attention-seeking, the lens shift is, the more movement we see in the child's body, the more vulnerable their nervous system is. So rather than the more movement and goofiness we see in the child's body, the more obnoxious they are and the more trying they are. And of course, I get it, because we're human, and we don't have the container to understand it in a new way. But if we can see that child as really having a difficult time managing either the expectations or the sensory environment around them, you may have children who behave a certain way only in a classroom, or in a restaurant, for example, where the auditory stimulation, the background noises bouncing off the walls, or the chatter amongst other children is so dysregulated to dysregulating to their nervous system that all of a sudden they start to feel antsy and do things that look really misbehaving, but what they're doing is showing you they have stress in their body.
Right, right. And I love the word, using the word vulnerable. So, you know, I feel like it's worth repeating, you know, when you're seeing that movement or even the goofiness, sometimes the silliness, you know, it's not bad behavior, but it's over the top behavior and it's disruptive. But it's showing us that their nervous system is vulnerable.
Is vulnerable, right? And let me even push that story a little further to what I observed quite a bit when I right before you know, schools went into home learning due to COVID. But I was in a classroom and a child started to engage in a behavior that was deemed to be disruptive. And on the IEP, the classroom aide and the teacher, and actually there are two aides in the classroom, everyone was instructed to start to ignore the child when they engaged in those behaviors so as not to reinforce it. And what happened over and over again is that because this child was connected to the aides and the teacher, and it was very disruptive to the child's nervous system to be ignored when they were already in a stress response. So it's actually the opposite of what this child needed. And for many children, including children with neurodivergent brains and autistic children and others who have individual differences, when you ignore a behavior that's a stress response, it can make them feel very, very alone and even increase the magnitude of that red pathway of the agitation.
So with this understanding that behavior is really a symptom and, you know, that is kind of the old roadmap of ignoring the behavior, what does the new roadmap look like for dealing with behavior and improving self-regulation?
Well, the new roadmap is, first of all, allowing us to see behaviors as valuable signals of what is going on in a child or what a child needs from the adults around them or from the ambient environment. So we want to view behaviors as valuable information rather than something we need to be afraid of or punish or consequence or reinforce. So that's kind of a significant shift for what we can do instead. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't take behavior seriously and that we don't provide loving, firm boundaries for children. Of course, we need to do all that. We need to keep everybody safe. But what it means is that we literally look beyond the behavior to understand what this means in the child's body. And this is the paradigm shift that I am bringing to the table and asking teachers and parents to think about. And that is the adaptive, protective nature of behaviors. So again, one easy way to think about it is that if you see the red pathway behaviors, the agitation, the hitting, the shoving, the spitting, those types of behaviors tell us that the child is already in the sympathetic fight or flight nervous system, the red pathway. And what they need at that moment is something called co-regulation and not and keeping them and others safe, but not a timeout, not discipline, not lecturing because they can't hear you very well. They need a compassionate adult witnessing. Oh my goodness, something's going on here. Sweetheart, let's figure this out together. What's going on? How are you feeling? And really moving towards children with those challenging behaviors. Now, ideally, this paradigm shift also involves, on the front end, trying to prevent and noticing those stress signals that children give off hours or minutes before they have the behavior. And that would be a whole different conversation, but we can absolutely look at those little stress signals that we see in the child's body that is warning us that something might be coming down the pipe.
And those stress signals, you know, if you connect that with movement as a way to start to notice, then even if you're not seeing a bad behavior or a behavior that isn't appropriate to the situation at that time, but you start to see movement increasing, that could be a signal.
That could be a signal. And let me define some other signals for you too. So you could see movement in the body, but look for micro movements. Look at the child's above the nose, look at the child's eyes. Hmm. Are the eyes darting around? Are they looking around the room fast? Are they wide open? Can you see the whites of the child's eyes? Mm-hmm. Both looking around fast and having wide open eyes are signs of internal stress. Mm-hmm. So also look at the jaw. Is the child clenching? Are they, do they have a look on their face that tells you that their body is shifting in some way? You might also look at their posture. Are they starting to position a posture of defense, like very tense, mm-hmm. or gripping, or looking like they're just about to pounce? You know, so look at these cues of the body. Some other signals that you can look at are related to our cardiovascular system. Are they, do they have sweaty hands, for example? Is that what's called the HPA axis? Is that starting to engage? Are they have little red faces or sweaty on their nose? Those are signs that the physiology is starting to shift towards the red and that the child needs support and engagement, social engagement, not run around and do 10 jumping jacks, Benny. But mm-hmm. hey, sweetheart, do you need a break? What are you thinking about? Can I sit with you for a moment? Those kinds of interactions are what bring a child back to the green.
That was really, really helpful. So I really encourage people. There's so much in here today, and I just really encourage our viewers to go back and listen. This just, there are so many nuggets in here, but that was really helpful. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers. And my guest today on LD Expert Live is Dr. Mona Delahook. So I want to talk a little bit about play. Play is a child's superpower, but now there are so many interesting things that kids can do online that play has taken on kind of a different meaning for many families. Can you give us a little primer on how to use play and why it is so important for development and regulation?
Mm. Well, the importance is can't be underestimated. And in 2019 or 2020, fairly recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics encouraged all pediatricians in the United States to actually prescribe play, to ask parents to allow their children to have free play or to play with their children. That tells you how much research there is behind mm-hmm. the benefits, the many multimodal benefits of play. They would not have recommended that if there wasn't a lot of research behind it. So when I was writing Brain Body Parenting, I did delve into the research, and it is incredible. The statistics around the social, emotional, cognitive, learning, social problem solving, social emotional development, all of these things, and general health too, all improve with the more children are allowed to play. So a couple things. There's different types of benefits for different types of play. So there are some studies that I talk about in the book that show us that children need more recess time, like free playtime where they're not told what to do. So if you're at a school or a preschool, hopefully they will have adequate amounts of free play and recess for children. The other type of play that I'm particularly interested in and is the type of play that I use in my practice to help children who are having difficulties in their emotional regulation and in their mental health is play with adults. And it's amazing how much you can learn about a child by playing with them. And here's the cool fact. You don't have to be a play therapist. Play provides its own magical benefits through a process called reenactment, whereby children reenact, again, it's not planned, but comes out through this process of play, which is the child's natural language. And I'm talking here mostly between, 9 months and about 10 years old. Because play looks different as you're a pre-adolescent and a teenager, but I'm talking about pretend play in particular, can help children move through trauma, stress reactions, difficulties at home, like with siblings. If they are in a tough situation, like children who have been in foster care, play provides the ability to work through emotional problems. And the thing that we can do as adults is set aside our phones and really remember to just follow the child's lead. Follow the child's lead without interrupting much. And be, if they ask you to be a kitty cat or a lion or a superhero, go into your actor mode and play with them. Play is magically healing.
And just so much is developed through play, socially, emotionally, as you said, also visual skills and you want your child to be able to sit in class and look from the board to their paper, those kinds of visual skills that allow them to read across a page when they're reading. Those are developed through movement first.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was on a conference call last night, visual spatial development. Absolutely. Our visual spatial system needs to be exercised through movement, right? That's how you learn to focus to things far away and up close and move from side to side. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that.
So that can be the gift.
Natural movement.
Yeah. That can be the gift we give our kids is free playtime without a device.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. As much as they love their devices, it keeps them stationary. And movement is very, very important for our visual system and everything else.
It keeps the visual system very focused. And we also need that. That bigger space to operate in. So
that bigger space, because when you're just working with central vision and not your peripheral vision, plus adding in your vestibular and proprioceptive systems at the same time, which what play integrates our sensory systems.
Right.
And too many of our kids are just holding one single plane and looking straight at a device. So yeah. Mm-hmm. All that I agree with.
Oh yes. All right. Well, I know we're starting to run out of time. I have one more thing for you. We tend to talk a lot about children, but we all have brains and bodies that are wired up together. So how would you apply all of these ideas that we've talked about today to teens, young adults, and even parents themselves as we head into the holidays and continue to deal with the stress of the pandemic?
Such a great question. Such a great place to end, because I truly wish that I had this information about how important the feedback from the body is as a teenager and as a young adult. I remember times in college and graduate school where I would wake up with a rapid heartbeat and grinding my teeth, these body-based things that, you know, like, what the heck, you know, it's just another day. But now we understand that if you are having a rapid heart rate, or if you feel sweaty, or if you are having trouble sleeping, if you have an ache in your stomach and you feel like you're on overdrive, so many adults have had their nervous systems challenged during the pandemic, even more. We're more burdened than before. Moms and dads and teachers and everybody is more burdened than before. So I would say just this compassionate awareness, simple awareness with a bit of compassion, that is not beating yourself up if you feel tired, not beating yourself up if you say no to a holiday event, for example, like you just don't have it and you feel like curling up on the couch and reading a book for 10 minutes. Having an awareness of our physical body is one of the best gifts we can give ourselves as teenagers, as adults, and even, of course, for our children too. So we matter, our bodies matter. And I'll just also say that it's pretty sobering to read the information about the chronic stress response, which actually results in inflammation throughout the body. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in your, you know, 30s or 40s or 20s, you may not experience the impact of that chronic inflammation, but it does pop up in the 50s and 60s. And believe me, as someone who's there, that happens before you know it. So it's also a way of maintaining our lifelong health so we can be there for our children and grandchildren.